once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English stead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Were you here, Jake, say?
Did I mean to say that?
That was a good one.
Thank you.
You sprang right to that one. And today, the program is brought to you by Plaid and Plain.
Yes.
And you can tell us apart today because Jake is today once again wearing his plaid, and Jeff is once again wearing plain. So we should be much easier to tell apart today than we normally are.
People do get confused, but this is the cheat sheet. You should be able to figure it out now.
Exactly. So as a disclaimer, we must announce, or we should announce, or we're going to at any rate, that the Personal Wealth Coach is not just the name of a radio program. It's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisor located in Salado, Texas, that provides investment advice on a fee-only basis, hopefully as fiduciaries. We sure try to be fiduciaries to our clients. And Jeff and Jake are both principals there and the prime speakers here. Secondarily, we need to tell you that you can call if today is Saturday, December 12th of 2015. You're certainly welcome to give us a call in here to ask any questions, make any comments, or just hold a general discussion about anything to do with economics or investing. And the telephone numbers are locally 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. Anywhere else within the sounds of our voices.
And it's very confusing in here because there used to be a little sticky on the 1812 control panel with the knobs and buttons on it that they stole from the Smithsonian.
Yes. Or sent back to it recently.
That had that had all those numbers on it, but it's gone now. There's this big flat thing with sliders all over it. You're probably getting tired of hearing about it, but it's pretty amazing to us. Anyway, so do give us a call if you have any thoughts, comments, or anything else about the economic weather that's going on. Stocks, where do we want to start?
Let's start with stocks.
Yeah. Beef bellies were...
No, not livestock.
That's briskets, by the way.
It's a common stock.
Common stock. Oh,
pork bellies is much more fun to eat.
Right. Is there a difference between common stock and livestock?
Depends on the context.
Okay. Well, the trader in Barron's announces stocks dropped 3.8% in overture to Fed meeting, which, like most headlines, is meaningless. The stock market did drop during the week. It was the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index was, see if I can find it here, for the week was down 3.79%. Year to date, it is down 2.26, and for 52 weeks, it is down 0.5%. That's a year, by the way, for those of you who don't track
52
this.
Weeks?
Is a year.
I don't have enough fingers and toes.
It's 2 bits, 4 bits, 52 weeks equals a year.
2 bits, 4 bits, 52. Right.
Okay.
Yeah,
and
that made sense.
Of course, the Dow Jones Industrial Averages had a relatively similar experience. The NASDAQ was down 4%, and the NASDAQ generally tends to rise and fall a little more than the S&P 500 or the Dow. So what we've got is, last week we were looking at the major stock indices creeping up towards a gain for the year and for year to date, and we were kind of hoping it would finish out the year with a positive note. There's 13 trading days left, and they're down.
Yeah.
And why are they down?
Because more people wanted to sell than wanted to buy.
Well, at least there were more shares, dollar value shares sold.
Yeah, more shares were being sold than were available to buy at that price. So
you
dropped the price.
You would ruin a newspaper.
I would say that every week. Nobody would read because he's going to say the same thing every week. It's like, why did the market go down? Well, because people were selling.
Well, the proximate.
Why?
The proximate.
Because they wanted money for something.
Claimed cause by traders, which in this case I think has a lot to do with the reality, because a 3%, 3.5% or whatever drop was pretty significant. And what happened was several things, but they're all tied together. The biggest one is a psychological barrier was breached. Don't you like that? Breaching barriers.
Psychologically.
Psychological barrier breach. We should have a B for psychological.
Which barrier are you talking about? Because I'm aware of more than one.
Well, the one that was breached, I think, that's pretty critical, is the $40.
That's the big one.
Limit, yeah. Low side. Everybody, there was sort of a consensus that, okay, West Texas Intermediate crude, which is a benchmark, an index, if you will, for the price of oil, probably will bottom out at about $40. A lot of people thought that, and a lot of people are hoping that was true. Well, it dropped down to about $36 by Friday, and
closed at $35.35.
It actually closed down to
$35.
During the day, I noticed it was down to $36. So that is a heck of a drop. Now, to put this in perspective.
You don't want to drop oil like that either. It splatters all over the place. You have a drop like that in, you know,
particularly
hard to clean up.
Particularly since in July of 2014, that recently, West Texas Intermediate crude was trading at $94+ per barrel. It is now at it's now down to roughly a third of that price. And that is a heck of a decline in the price of oil, and this is one of those things where I bring this up for several reasons. One, it's a profound issue and very important to the economy. And secondly, it's one that you can actually see. All you have to do is drive to your nearest gas station and look at the price of regular gasoline.
Yeah. A lot of times when prices are quoted, it's not something that has a direct impact on people's lives. Mm-hmm. This is one that they drive around and they say, oh, well, prices of gasoline are down.
Right.
I never thought I would see it below
$2
a gallon, and now it's getting down far enough that mm-hmm. we might see it lower than that.
Well, it is. It was $1.79 the other day when I pulled up to a gas station. Mm-hmm. I don't pay a lot of attention to it. But
I've seen it at $1.40 mm-hmm. in Dallas.
And I think very conceivably, hang on to your seats, we could see it down to $1.
That's reasonable. Part of the reason why the price is as high as it is right now in gasoline is if you look at the where oil companies are making money, it's not the little oil companies making money. It's the big ones. And they're ones that own at least percentages of income off of mm-hmm. convenience stores and gas stations. And the price of gas has fallen much slower than the underlying oil that's being refined and supplied to these gas stations. And the reason is because they don't have to keep up with it. They're actually padding their pockets a little bit by slowing down the drop of gas prices. Eventually, it's got to get down there.
There was, in looking at what's going on in the economy in the first 2 months of the year and the first 2 months of the fiscal year, the government's fiscal year and so on, the largest decline in revenues and profits in the economy, down 6.4% in that 2 months from a year ago, is in gasoline-oriented convenience stores.
Right.
And there's a whole series of things. But this is the point. Here's the deeper meaning to why the price of oil falling to a surprising new low in this recent cycle has an effect on the stock market. There's a big unknown out there, and that is that a lot of companies that, and it's going to be a bit of a surprise when we figure out who they are, have loaned a lot of money to wildcatters and other organizations that were doing fracking. And that money was loaned out at oil approaching $100 a barrel in some markets. And the assumption was it would stay there. Now, that is, in my humble opinion, a foolish assumption, because if you have high prices in a commodity, and by the way, we found this is going on across all the commodities, not just oil. It's also going on in aluminum and copper and gold and all of the commodities that are mined, and gold and oil is effectively mined. A tremendous amount of money was invested, mainly in the form of loans from our perspective today, into these companies so that they could build facilities to extract that raw material from the ground, move it to where it could be refined into something that could be sold, and then sold. Well, a lot of people did that all at once.
Yeah.
And
in fact, if you...
They all came online pretty much all at once.
There are a couple of episodes of this particular program, the one you're listening to right mm-hmm. now, that if you go back 3 years and 2 years even, you will hear us talking about oil limited partnerships and how they're a bad idea, mm-hmm. that you don't want to get into the top of the market. And sadly, a lot of people didn't listen to this program. Or if they did, they just ignored it, which is a reasonable thing.
Do you mean to say that there's a lot of people in the country who don't listen to this radio program?
I don't know why. I don't know why.
I don't know that there's...
there may be a lot of...
We don't know that anybody's even listening, except maybe the two of us, and we're not really... Anyway,
what did you say?
To give you an example of what's going on in the big wide world out there, there's a company called Kinder Morgan, it's a mining and oil extraction and pipeline company.
Mm-hmm.
They just cut their dividend 75%.
Yeah, well, they've had a 30% drop in the past couple of months.
Right. And if you go around, and right now, if you were hunting for dividend-paying stocks, oil-related, particularly pipeline companies, have, because their stocks have dropped in value, are paying out like 10 to 13% dividends a year. And you say, wow, what a deal. Why don't I just buy into that and they'll pay me 10 to 13%? Well, there's going
to
be a little surprise.
Drop the dividends.
And
those dividends have to do with profits, and when the profits drop, they don't mm-hmm. pay the same.
The other thing is there's a lot of companies that have issued something called junk. We call them junk bond. And by the way, I noticed that high yield is converting to junk.
Right. They're now calling it junk because they're realizing, hey, this stuff is dangerous. It's not just high yield anymore.
And
it means the same thing. If you have a credit card that's charging you 30% to use it, to the credit card, you are a high yield customer. But the reason why they're charging 30% is because they don't.
They figure you're only going to last about 3.5 years.
Right.
They need to get their money back.
So high-yield bonds are the same thing. It's they wouldn't have to pay that interest rate if they had a better credit rating, a better credit score.
And so what you've got is a lot of money has been loaned at high interest rates to oil-related companies. And the assumption behind those loans, at least according to what I have been reading in Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, and other places, is oil at $85 a barrel.
That's not a good assumption for a while.
And there is no time on the horizon right now where we can see $85 oil again.
I'm not often one to make short-term predictions, but I mm-hmm. did last week.
What's that?
I brought up OPEC and the meeting that they had where they didn't come to a decision on lowering the amount of oil that they're pumping.
They actually came to a decision that we're going to do whatever we wanted
to. Right, and basically they came to the decision that OPEC didn't do anything. It's
right.
The individual countries that are making the decisions. And I said at the time, well, expect the oil prices to drop. And during the time period since then, the oil per barrel has dropped $7.
Mm-hmm.
From last week,
and you're dropping oil again.
It's a mess. Don't step in it; it's slippery. So that I'm bringing it up because people often seem surprised when we could make an observation like that. But this is one of those things where there's certain areas that it's no brainer. Iran is coming back online with at least, and this is a very low estimate of the amount of oil that they're going to be putting out, at least 2 million barrels a day.
2 million here, 2 million there. Pretty soon you're talking about some real oil production.
Right. Well, the reality is that they're probably going to bring that up to somewhere around 12 million barrels a day.
Did you hear their argument at OPEC?
Which, Iran?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you give your version of it.
Well, my understanding of their argument at OPEC is, look, we have been locked out of the oil
yeah.
market for umpteen years
yeah.
now. So whatever our quota was going into this thing, we can exceed whatever quota you assigned to us by that amount
right,
until we make up the difference.
Yeah, and basically what they're saying, exactly that.
Which is more oil than they have, by the way.
They haven't been able to sell it, so they feel like they should be able to sell it at a faster rate. Now, put that in context with the fact that world demand for oil is 2 million barrels a day less than world production of oil.
And it's about to go to 4 million.
Right.
Less.
When Iran hits with their sales, it goes to 4 million. And it's probably going to get ramped up, not down from there. And the people that are still trying to pay these high interest debts in the United States, mm-hmm. they don't have the ability to slow down the production. They've got to speed it up in order to pay their debts. And that causes the overall.
Right.
This is something that economists call the plight of the commons. And it's happening in reverse order in this particular case. It tends to swing back and forth. When there is a common item that a lot of people want, and there's not a lot of it around, then we try to use it up faster than it's able to be produced, which causes more people to think about better ways of it, which causes, as long as we're not talking about animals and fish, it causes, as long as there's actually more of it out there that's just harder to get to, it causes the technology to get cheaper to get the thing. If we're talking about animals and fish, it causes us to kill them all. The plight of the commons, when applied to tuna fishing or whale fishing, causes no more whales and tuna because this actually is a nice little exercise because a lot of the plight of the commons has to do with cattle, with the early research in it. So you would have a common area for grazing. And so I'm going to put together a little example of this. Say you, across from me, old Baldy Jeff, has some cattle, and I have some cattle, and we have roughly the same amount of cattle. And we're sharing some property to graze on. We call that common area, which is why it's common stock, by the way. That's a different story, though. So we have a common that we're grazing in. And there's a drought that comes along. And we look around and we go, man, we got to lower the amount of cattle that we have on the grazing area, or we're going to overgraze and nobody's going to have any cattle out there. So in a best case scenario, in the perfect world, we would get together and say, okay, you drop 5 cows, I drop 5 cows. However, there's also something called the prisoner's dilemma that fits in here very well, where the first person that looks out for their own best interest first
wins.
So if one of us decides in the process, we've just agreed we're going to lower by 5 head of cattle each, and one of us, instead of lowering by 5 head of cattle, throws 20 cows into the field, not literally because that would be really heavy, but gets 20 more cows into the field. So instead of going down in numbers, it went up. Well, then the first person that does that gets a lot more money because at the time of a drought, beef prices go up. And now you can sell all those cows.
Actually, at the time of the drought,
the beef prices go down.
They go down.
And then
yes,
afterwards,
right.
They go up. So you can say he found somebody else that's trying to get rid of their cows, their 5 head of cows off of their common grazing area. And so bought a bunch of those, threw them on the property. And now the property gets overgrazed, but the person that put the most cattle on there leaves with the most stuff. And when you're talking about oil, it's a really good representation here. There's oil out there that's hard to get to. And if oil prices get high enough, we find better ways of getting to it.
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking about tuna in the ocean and we have national quotas, it's a great place. There's people have won Nobel Prizes on looking at tuna fish in the oceans, Nobel Prizes in economics, and the plight of the commons there. Because this great conglomeration of nations say, let's lower the amount of tuna fish that we take. And then one nation will say, well, I'm going to raise the amount that we can take. Since you guys are all lowering it, I'm going to raise the amount. So then all the other nations raise their amounts too.
Mm.
So and that's, it is a plight in that.
Particularly if you're a tuna.
If you're a tuna, it's a real plight. But that concept applied to oil, when there's that much oil available under the ground still. I mean, the fact that we have found so much in Texas, so much in North Dakota, we have enough to keep the United States in oil for a century underground here in Texas at current demand. More than that, if they continue to find more of it. And that means that it doesn't really matter a whole lot what OPEC does. The price is going to remain low because the technology is getting better, not worse.
But the problem with the price ever rising,
mm-hmm.
is, first off, a lot of companies are going to go out of business, and other companies are going to buy them.
Right.
And so the oil, the proven oil reserves are going to be there with pumps.
Already attached.
Already attached, with pipelines already attached, with everything already attached to make it. So if the oil, what's going to happen is a lot of oil companies are going to go out of business. Little oil companies.
Mm-hmm. With high debt.
And maybe some big ones. That's always, we always say, well, the big ones really are safe. No, they're not.
They're not. Some of them are thinking ahead, but most of them are still.
So then the issue is the companies that loaned them money. Now, we don't know. Now, here's the point.
Who did it?
This is where the big financial crisis came from. Now, this isn't as big as the big financial crisis, but a lot of the market and a lot of people who invest, I would say the vast, vast majority, were unaware who was loaning money to build all these houses.
Right. The subprime
ultimately
loans. Who gave those loans out?
Yeah, in other words, yeah, the mortgage company gives the loan out, but who buys that loan from them? And in buying that loan from them, winds up with a big, carrying the risk.
Right.
And it turned out that it was banks and insurance companies. And nobody was, I don't think people were particularly ready for the fact, they just were unaware that these AAA rated collateral, I love the way that they were sold.
Collateralized mortgage obligations.
Well, they weren't just collateral. When they were originally sold, at least at the retail level, it was simply called collateralized debt.
Right.
In other words, there was collateral behind the debt, therefore it should be safer than debt without collateral.
Right, right.
And there, bonds are debt, by the way. So here's what's going on in the market today. We don't know who has loaned the many, many, many hundreds of billions of dollars to all these oil companies and the pipeline companies.
Some of them are not going to be paid back.
And it could be insurance companies. It could be banks. Odds are against it being banks because the regulators have been really hard on the banks. But the key that kind of set off the collapse was a mutual fund. Third Avenue Focused Credit, was that it?
I think that's right.
Focused something. Anyway, was out on the leading edge of junk bonds and had purchased a lot of very high interest bonds. But those high interest bonds had limited liquidity. And there is the key. Limited liquidity meaning they're just not a big market for that particular level of bond. There is at any given moment, as long as people are buying high interest bonds. But as soon as people aren't really interested in buying high interest bonds that are based on oil companies paying their debts, they couldn't sell the bonds anymore. And about that time, the investors in this very narrowly focused alternative mutual fund, and these were alternatives, said, whoa, this looks like a bad sector of the market. We want out. So they started liquidating. And Third Avenue suddenly discovered that they couldn't sell their bonds.
There's not a market for it.
In an orderly fashion to pay the shareholders who wanted to liquidate. So A, they closed the fund. B, they stopped redeeming, and they have appealed. They have filed with the SEC that over the next several months, in an orderly fashion, about 6 months period, they will sell these bonds, and by the way, they will sell them at a deep discount, probably to what they paid for them.
Right.
And they will return the money to the investors. And that sounds an awful lot like what a hedge fund does.
Right. It's important to recognize that any time a mutual fund takes one small sector of the market and says, this is our area and we're going to load up on it, if that sector of the market becomes difficult to sell or buy.
There's a short word for that, tanks.
Tanks, yeah, basically where they have a lot of investment, but nobody's willing to buy it from them. Well, you shouldn't expect to get your money out anytime soon. And that's one of the issues that happened with the collateralized debt and so on in the past as well.
But there's an underlying key here. And it isn't going to make you happy that the market dropped and has been flat for the year. But the fact that the market's flat for the year is not a bad deal anyway. But this is the point that is creating this micro crisis. And it's only a micro crisis because the S&P 500 is still above 2,000. I mean, it's not like we've had a market crash. It's just like it's retreated a little bit. But here is there's an underlying piece of wisdom here, and a lot of people are going to lose a lot of money. At the big sophisticated investors are going to lose a lot of money because they don't pay attention to this little piece of wisdom. And that is, anytime you reach for high interest rates, anytime you try to find a high interest rate, particularly if it's a sure thing of some sort, that's higher than you can get in a CD at the bank or from a short-term treasury, you're taking risk. And here's, listen carefully, the risk goes up exponentially with the interest rates. Now, that's a big term, but what that means is the risk goes up 10 times faster than the interest rates go up. So if interest rates on CDs, you can get a two-year CD right now for, if you really hunt, for 1%, and or a little less, 1% a year. And when you've got a company that's paying 10% on a master limited partnership, that's another area where people are going to lose a lot of money, in oil pipelines, and they're paying a 10% dividend, and you're thinking, this is a great deal. I can get 10%, whereas the other dummies are only getting 1%. Stand by to lose potentially all of the money you invested. Because if you go from 1 to 10, you go from a 0% chance of loss other than through inflation to look. Now, I want you to take it by, if you go to 10 and you multiply that times 10, that's exponential. That means you stand a reasonable chance of taking a 100% loss. Now, that is a statistical element. It doesn't mean in every company is going to do that. But here's what a lot of people have done. They have chased high yield. They're chasing other places right now where interest or some form is guaranteed. We're guaranteeing your principal and we'll pay you money to boot. Yeah, sure. If it's not FDIC insured or backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, run from that promise. But this is where we are, and that's the bad news. The good news is things are about to get a lot better, in my opinion.
Yeah, and it's a lot better in a lot of directions.
And let me give you, I know I'm kind of
right. I've got
here.
Something to hit right after this.
Okay.
So it's in the same vein.
I just, you know, we've just given you some, oh, this is terrible. People are going to lose a lot of money in the oil patch, like you didn't already know that. Just like they did in the 80s, just like they've done many, many times in the past. You'd think they'd learn, but they don't. They don't read history. Here is the good news. I have right here from Morningstar the receipts, expenditures, and deficit data for the United States government for fiscal year 2015, which ended 2 months ago, by the way. And they've got it all together. And here's the good news. Total spending by the United States government for everything they spend money on, everything, during the year went up 5.4%. But, now, remember that the economy didn't do diddly squat this year.
Right.
That's a term I use. That's an economic term.
Technical.
Yeah,
you can look that up. It's under diddly.
Did not do diddly squat. Right. If it did diddly squat, that would be good. And the stock market is down for the year, which indicates, if the stock market was a pure indicator, that the economy must have been down for the year, right?
If it isn't.
Okay.
But yeah.
Here's the good news. You really want to know how well the economy did last year? It's really simple. You look at the revenue received by the United States government in the form of taxes, which
right.
they have to pry out of people with a crowbar, okay? Believe me, you got to make a profit to pay the government.
Right.
Revenues to the United States government through taxes, that's individual taxes, payroll taxes, corporate taxes, and other receipts, which is basically stuff going across the borders and fines and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
Revenue was up 7.6% in fiscal year 2015, a year that in all other aspects looks flat. The revenue to the United States government without a raise in taxes went up 7.6%.
Well, there was a raise of taxes.
Well, the taxes went into effect before that.
Right.
Though.
It's just kind of hitting now.
But that did not have any significant effect. That would fall under, that would actually go into Social Security. The raise in taxes actually goes into the Social Security Fund, so it really isn't counted here, oddly enough. This is actual direct taxes from the United States government, not the increase in payroll tax that the Medicare increases. That
I'm talking about capital gains increases for upper income and...
Yeah, well, that was...
The upper income bracket getting bigger and steeper.
The upper income bracket getting bigger, a lot more. That's the other thing. There's another other news there is that the upper income people who pay the upper income taxes.
That's what I'm going to talk about.
Okay, I'll let you get into that. But this is the point. Without a tax increase of any significance whatsoever, it had no effect on the revenues to the United States government that was measurable. Revenues to the United States government, mainly through taxes, increased 7.6%. That meant the economy really, truly, no joke, honestly grew at 7.6% last year.
Right, and there's a...
In 2015.
Yeah, there was a big report that came out this week, middle class shrinking, income gap widening. It sounds like this horrible event. Well, I've read the study, and... People that have been listening to this.
It's a Pew. It stinks.
It's Pew. Yes, yeah. The Pew Research Institute put it together. The Pew Research Center put it together. And people that have been listening to this program for very long know that this data isn't new. I've been talking about this by looking at the tax rolls of the United States government because it says what your income is. And that's what the Pew folks did. They just went to the Treasury's website and did the same spreadsheets I did, and then they printed it out. Anyway... What they said
is they got a lot more money for it than you did.
Right, right. Yeah, they got paid a lot of money for this report. It's not that difficult to do. And what they've said is that the middle income group, the middle class of America, has shrunk. In 1971, it was 61% of the population, and now it's at 50% of the population. We've lost 11% of the people out of the middle class.
I hope you're about to contradict yourself.
Well, we have. We've lost 11% of the people out of the middle class, but most of those 11% went into upper income. This is a good thing. This is what we want the middle class to do. Everybody in the middle class wants to be upper income.
But if you ask those people in the lower third of the upper income group, if they're in the upper income...
They're going to say they're middle class. So
the middle class just got bigger. It just has more money now.
Right. Some of this is some mathematical gymnastics in that the amount of money that you have to make to be in the middle class, first you have to make more than the people in the lower class, duh, and less than the people in the upper class. Okay.
But
who sets those numbers?
Yeah, that's the key.
And that number is arbitrary.
It's set by some bureaucrat.
Well, not just some bureaucrat. There are different bureaucrats with different numbers.
Well, it's set by a lot of different bureaucrats.
Right. And in this case, the Pew folks said, well, we're going to use these numbers. And they didn't do a whole... I mean, those numbers, and if you look at the graph on their report, those numbers change every year. Well, again, kind of a duh. We got inflation and stuff, right? Well, no, it's not changing with inflation. It's changing an arbitrary amount every year.
And a little disclosure here. The Pew Center is not noted for right-wing politics.
Right. So
they are somewhat to the left of center.
What happened here in this strange event is that in the year 2000, Pew folks said that if you've got three people in your family and you made more than $133,000, you were upper income.
Oh, wow.
Okay. We've had inflation since then. It's been real.
Yes.
Incomes are up across the board since then.
Mm-hmm.
However, the borderline to get into upper income has dropped. It's dropped by $7,000 a year. So now it's at $125,000.
It really boils down to the fact that there's more rich people.
Wait, you would think that if the number that drops, you know, the number to get into upper mm-hmm. income dropped, then the number to get out of lower income would drop too.
No, it moved up.
It went up.
Yeah.
So those numbers are making the middle class smaller, and it's arbitrary.
So the Pew Research Center is shrinking the middle class.
Yes. That's the end result here.
That should be the headline. Pew Research Center shrinks
middle
class.
Yeah. If you look at the end result, the numbers, though, more people are making more money.
Exactly.
That's the end result. That's the takeaway from this. All that data that they put together and they crafted carefully for use by the media in that their headline is, the American middle class is losing ground. That's the cover of the research report. This is a huge, I mean, the font size of that particular thing is about 20 times the size of anything behind it. And you really have to read the whole thing to realize that maybe it's losing ground if you define it as a smaller and smaller amount of income and then allow people to go up into the, and as you said, the people that are in the lower block of the upper income would never in their wildest dreams consider themselves to be upper income, particularly when a larger percentage of people in the population are in there now.
When you look at the fact that the United States government, not by its official proclamations, but by its actions, says that a couple filing jointly with an adjusted gross income of $250,000,
right,
or more.
That's upper income.
That's upper income.
That is not the way it looks.
If you define it that way,
research, then,
and then if you say
the middle class has grown drastically,
then if you say the lower class, whatever that is,
if you use the poverty level, which is a pretty standard method of doing it, the poverty level is smaller.
So if you use the lower class, you say, okay, there is a set of people out there who are Congress over the years, including the people who are in Congress today, have said, okay, these people need a little bit of a helping hand sometime. We either need to reduce their taxes dramatically or maybe give them a little credit here or something there. And you look at that entire set of numbers where you say we shouldn't be taking as much money from these people as we take from other people. Now, for example, you could say, okay, everybody who's in the 15% or lower tax bracket.
Right.
By definition, are not upper class, and they're probably not middle class. Then what you see is a couple of things. Number one, that set of people is now making more money than they did in 2000. And that's, by the way, one of the things that actually came out in the report is the amount of money being made by the working, whatever the working class is, like the rest of us don't.
You're working and we're not because we make more money than you. Wait a minute. What? Wait.
There's the working class, the middle class, and the upper class. And I really wonder, with my degree in anthropology, cultural anthropology, where the heck did they get those definitions?
Well, I think those definitions were made by academics, and they don't define themselves.
They don't work
as
anyway, right?
They just study stuff.
Well, there's a separate set called the academic class.
Right, the academic class, and that's what the research study should show. Academic class getting stronger.
Academia nuts.
Yes.
Oh boy, we're having a lot of fun here.
Too much fun. Shame on us.
Across the board, and so don't listen to this foolishness. When you have the revenue to the United States government going up by 7.6%,
and you have more people making more money, and yet the headline is the middle class is shrinking.
But this is the point in that. There is no question that we are becoming more wealthy as a nation if our taxable revenue went up by 7.6% last year. Well, it's when I say last year, last fiscal year. For 2015, the government's 2015, which ends in a different time than the rest of the world, which
makes sense
somehow
if you're the
makes a weird sense. It used to end in July, by the way. I remember when they moved it from July to October to reduce the deficit.
Right. It's easier to reduce the deficit if your year is shorter.
I think they should just go ahead and move it to the end of the year now that they moved it to, you know, they moved it 90 days.
Might as well just make it the same as everybody else's
year. Yeah, just make
year.
It the same as everybody else's year, and that would be, but that
it's
would
like
cause
the U.S. government is deciding to have leap years when nobody else is. What is that about?
One of the
What's
reasons.
The end of your year? Mine is December 31st.
One of the reasons they don't do that, by the way, is visible in Congress right now. They just passed a 5-day extension for the government. The government runs out. The government officially shuts down on Wednesday now.
Right, instead of Friday.
Instead of last Friday. And you notice, by the way, there's no headlines. Government scheduled to shut down on Friday.
No, it's just kind of.
But even Friday's was an extension. Well, they punched another extension in, but all of the leaders in Congress and all but a very few people in the Freedom Caucus are firmly behind that we will not have a government shutdown.
Right.
Even if we have to pass another 5-day extension. You'll notice that the reason that we don't have a fiscal year that ends on December 31st is Congress ain't no way they're going to get a budget passed coming up to Christmas and they want to stay gone for a while after Christmas for, to get over their hangovers from New Year's Day.
Right.
And so they can't move it another 90 days to, again, adjust the deficit.
No. Why would they want to do that? I mean, 90 days is
and then they'd have 5 days. Then they'd have to pass their budget in advance.
Right.
The Congress doesn't do things in advance.
No, they're retarded.
Right.
Literally. And you know, we've said this before. Last time I said this, by the way, not the last time, but the time one very notable time I said this, if pro is the opposite of Kong, is Congress the opposite of progress? And John Carter walked in the door. But that's the last time he ever walked in the door because we were already being a little bit critical of Congress.
Yeah.
And congressmen.
We've only gotten more so.
Yeah. Anyway, the point I want to make here is underlying the economy, the engine that drives the United States economy is mainly consumer spending. Consumers spend when they make more money, when they make more money. They obviously made more money because they paid more taxes. And a lot of that is payroll taxes, which indicate they were making more money. They're through the same time period, consumer spending went up 3.9%. And the indications we're seeing right now from places like Amazon, which is the biggest retailer now, is that we're likely to see like about a 6.4% increase in Christmas spending this year over last year, which is huge, which means that the retailers, the retail purchases, which makes up, again, 70% of our economy, are very likely to jump very much in accordance with the amount of money that the federal government took in more last year than they took in the year before, 7.6%. In other words, we are looking...
We've got a good growth rate going.
At the main driving engine in our economy, spinning up very nicely. And we got to do commercials, don't we?
Yes, we do.
Doggone it. We could just be a socialist state. We wouldn't have to do commercials.
Think of all of the things we could save. We would all stand in line and wait to get bread. But think of all of the comrades we would gain by standing in line together.
Yes, and we could all learn to speak Russian.
Right.
Okay. Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and presuming today is December 12th, 2015, you can give us a call at 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
But you ought to wait till after the commercials. We'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone numbers in here remain 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. Your microphone is wilting. They have a pill for that.
They do?
Yeah.
Yeah, they have it right here. It's a big steel thing called a screwdriver. Anyway, as we were saying, we had a commodity sort of meltdown a little bit in bonds. One of the things that came out of this with this bond fund closing and saying, hey, we're going to shut down and we're going to gradually give the money back over a period of time, which shocks people to no end when that happens, is we have been warning for some time about a thinness in the bond market, a shallowness, if you will, so that if a lot of liquidations were attempted in a short period of time, there would be places in the bond market, because there is no bond market. I know that sounds a little strange. I just said there'd be places in the bond market, but there is no bond market. There'll be places in certain types of bonds that probably will drop effectively to zero because you can't sell them. Now, I know that sounds absurd. There is a stock market. There's a lot of stock markets. There's the New York Stock Exchange. There's the NASDAQ. There's the DAX. There's all kinds of stock markets around the world where stocks are traded in a central location so that all the buyers and all the sellers can come together. There is no centralized bond market. It involves a lot of individual bond traders who communicate electronically looking for bond buyers. And you could say, well, that's a really cool way of doing business, except if a market maker in a given bond stops making the market, it's going to be very, very hard to sell that bond. And there was an advertisement a moment ago for municipal bonds. Municipal bonds right now are, I understand why they're advertising them, they are paying a higher interest rate than regular bonds in many cases for the same duration, the same maturity. That should warn you that somebody says that there is a bigger risk out there that they won't pay. I don't know why that is, but it's one of the principles of finance that if somebody is offering a higher interest rate than true safe money, no matter what they say about the offering, it is carrying a higher risk.
Right. It's kind of like if you went to the store and there are two products that are identical to each other and one costs more than the other. They're absolutely identical. Why would you buy the one that costs more? And when you're going to get a loan for your house and you've got two mortgage offers that are from two different lenders, and you compare them and their fees are the same, but one is going to charge you a higher interest rate. It's going to charge you a significantly higher interest rate. Unless there's something a little bit wrong with you, you're going to choose the lower interest rate. It's less expensive. And the same is true for bonds. When people are going to the bond market, they're getting loans, just like you do to buy a house.
Mm-hmm.
And if they shop around and they say, all right, this is the best interest rate we can get, they're going to choose the best interest rate they can get. And if they're paying a higher interest rate than other like entities, other like companies or municipalities, then it's because somebody doesn't think that they can pay it as well.
Let's come off of that disclosure that you may have heard in the commercials just a minute, in the commercial just a minute ago. If you were able to listen that quickly at the beginning of the commercial, that as interest rates go up, the value of bonds go down. As interest rates go down, the value of bonds go up. So the higher the interest rate, the lower the value of the bond. That's a principle that there are rare exceptions to that, but let's just go with that, okay? So Jake was just talking about something. If you're trying to get a mortgage loan, and one company is offering you a loan at a higher interest rate and one is offering you a loan at a lower interest rate, this is really simple. The one with the lower interest rate has more value to you.
Yes. It's going to cost you less money to get that loan.
So it's more valuable to you. And that's the way they are when they sell on the secondary market. Now, why is it that we just heard an advertisement for municipal bonds, which you haven't heard on this radio program in many, many years? And there's a reason when somebody is advertising something to the public and they're advertising on an AM radio program, which I hate to break this to you, but the average listener to an AM radio program is not quite as sophisticated as the typical guy who is in New York City trading bonds.
Well, by sophisticated, we mean
financially sophisticated.
Yeah.
And you can be sophisticated in a lot of other areas. I mean, those guys up there don't know anything about cows or pigs or a lot of other things that you know about and I know a little bit about. But why are municipal bonds then paying a higher interest rate, and why do we suddenly have advertisements for municipal bonds on KTEM? And it's kind of like during the housing boom, just before the bust, there were a lot of advertisements about how to flip houses.
KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood. Proud to broadcast to the largest military post in the free world. News Radio 1400 KTEM.